Professional wrestling is the one true sport. Other sports have their share of intense, dramatic moments, but nothing can compare with professional wrestling. Welcome to Wrestling History X, where three friends come together to talk about the stories behind the matches. I'm Matt.
I'm a member of the Backbone of America.
And I am Michael Virgil Vinchaint Jones.
Rest in peace.
Welcome to episode 259, Great American Bash, 1997.
Give him a nice warm hug on Father's Day.
It's a hard one to sync up with.
That's a nice warm hug on Father's Day.
Yeah.
Okay. Who doesn't want a nice warm hug on Father's
Day? I guess they could have done like maybe,
give him your daddy?
Give him a bear hug, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was the 7th Great American Bash produced by WCW, but the 11th overall if you include Jim Crockett Productions.
Yeah, as it used to be a tour.
And it took place on June 15th, 1997, from the Mark of the Quad Cities in Moline, Illinois, with an attendance of 9,613.
Should have done it in Boston.
Perhaps gathering they the marks.
I mean, 9,000 people is not horrific, but
it's half the crowd of Nitro last week.
I know, it's crazy.
Nitro last week was pulling these, you know, Cody Rhodes numbers from today for house shows.
Yeah, 16,000 people last week and 9. It's like, weird.
But there's a difference in who's here this week and who was there last week, I guess.
Like I said, I don't feel like we go to Boston very often, with whether it's WWF or WCW. Granted, we don't watch as much of the weekly television, but still.
And see, I'm trying to think of when WCW was in Boston last before Nitro. Because, yeah, typically that's more of a WWEF
area
spot. Not as southern, but, you know, they're breaking out. It's 1997. You gotta try some new places.
I do love that, now everything's it's the Dunkin' Donuts Arena. But this thing's called the Mark of the Quad Cities, which is, makes it sound like
perfect
it means
for
something.
Wrestling.
Yeah. Absolutely. Last week we were at the Fleet Center. I don't know what that means. But, you know, Greensboro Coliseum.
I can answer your question.
Okay.
The last time WCW had been in Boston was a house show in 1990. And the time before that on the 1989 Great American Bash Tour.
There you go.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, they were just hungry.
Two shows in almost a decade.
They were hungry. NWO is hot.
Sting was hot.
Yeah, Sting, definitely. I mean, at that last show, there was four guys in the front. They were Brock bought the Sting shirt and immediately put it on.
So WWF really hadn't run Boston either, only doing house shows in 97, 95, 94... 1993 with Survivor Series.
So I was going to say there was a Survivor Series.
But literally, since the Survivor Series, they'd only run house shows.
So there's been three, or four wrestling shows.
In the last 4 years, basically.
Yeah, of note.
Yeah.
Of the, two major companies. So, yeah, it's just and wrestling's heating up at this moment.
Yep.
So it makes sense why there's so many people there.
But we are in Moline, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Which, just to give perspective where Moline is, it's basically on the other side of a bridge from Davenport, Iowa. So
Davenport,
it's the
Iowa.
South
home of West Seth Rollins, right?
Corner of Illinois.
Yeah, so it's it makes sense. If they were in Chicago, the number would have been bigger.
Yeah.
There's not as many people.
Correct. But we are there. So Shane, did you do what you do?
I did some stuff and some things, and we'll find out if it's
thingable.
Yeah. We are in Moline, Illinois.
Moline.
In the Mark Center, or whatever that place is called.
Yeah, I mean, the Mark Center is fine. It's filled with 9,000 wrestling fans.
9,000 marks. But yes, We're in Illinois. I don't know exactly how far we are from Chicago. I know we're about 2.5 hours away from Springfield, just because what I brought is something that was, I guess, created in Springfield. It's known as the Horseshoe Sandwich.
Oh,
interesting.
I had to get creative with this one last minute because, as sometimes happens, you order something from DoorDash and it doesn't come with all of the ingredients. I'm not going to bash the place for it because accidents happen. And I've been there before and they've, you know, put out a pretty tasty product. So, you know, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. It was just a slip of the mind. But yeah, the Horseshoe Sandwich is basically it's a burger placed on top of a piece of bread, topped with French fries, and then smothered in a cheese sauce.
Hangover food.
Pretty much.
Put an egg on there. That's like basically a Bloody Mary.
You put an egg on anything, and I'm game. I'm a happy Shane.
Is this horse shit on a shingle?
The Horseshoe Sandwich is the official sandwich of Illinois, or one of them, I guess you could say. But many Illinois residents north of I-80 have never heard of it.
Southern Illinois sandwich.
Yes. The Horseshoe Sandwich, I guess the fries represent the nails for the horseshoe. I don't know.
Yeah, you gotta stand them up like a like candles in a birthday cake.
The Horseshoe Sandwich is... I guess they put ham on it as well.
Uh-huh.
And the ham is cut in the shape of a horseshoe.
Okay.
Weird. But yeah, essentially it's just a piece of toast, a burger, French fries, and cheese sauce. I ordered this one from our friends over at New State Burger and Spirits, and it's what's known as their hot hamburger. It's a Texas toast with a double burger on top of it, French fries, and then it's supposed to have brown gravy, but the brown gravy was left behind, so I had to raid Michael's fridge and come up with a quick, fast cheese sauce using some simple ingredients of milk and some melting Mexican cheese, a little bit of mozzarella, some salt and pepper, a little pinch of butter, and then just did a quick whisk in a pan, threw some flour in there to help thicken it up a little bit.
It's more authentic.
Yes.
Without the gravy. So maybe they did us a favor. Maybe they knew that I had those things.
And see, I'd attempted to look around to see if there was any place that had a cheese sauce available, like burger-wise, but I couldn't find one that was readily available in DoorDash that I had been to before, because I don't want to order from, you know, Pimp My Burger or something like that.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what...
Pimp My Burger is just Denny's,
stuff they're gonna bring.
Denny's kitchen, probably.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to go and try the official hot hamburger at New State just to see what it's like with the gravy and not delivered. I'm not gonna take a bite of it on the mic because it's kind of ice cold and congealed now. The cheese sauce is officially cold and stuck to the plate, but
it was very delicious.
It's tasty, good, yeah.
Well, something that would hit theaters around the same time as Great American Bash.
Mm-hmm.
My Best Friend's Wedding.
Take it away, boys.
I didn't
never
even look to see
it.
What our movies were this week.
I've never
awesome.
Seen it. Is this who's in this?
Julia Roberts. Okay. Dermot Mulroney, Cameron Diaz, and Rupert Everett.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I like all those people just fine. Never caught this one.
Oh, that's a great one.
If you had me try to watch this in 97, I would have, just left the room. As a child. This is not for me.
It was a great rom-com. I really feel that Rupert Everett was robbed of award nominations because he should have gotten an Oscar nomination, a Golden Globe nomination, and all those other thingies. That kind
of... This is like the height of Julia Roberts, kind of, too, right? Or maybe a little after?
Yeah, I mean, this is pre-Aaron Brockovich.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the last movie around this time. I think she had... The Pelican Brief had come out a few years before. What is that one with Mel Gibson?
I think she had just done Mary Riley and...
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that one.
So when's Pretty Woman? Is that...
That was 1990.
Oh, okay, yeah. So I guess she does pop earlier, but she's still, you know, yeah, bankable star.
She's already had her Steel Magnolias in her Pretty Woman days. Now she's...
This is the first one of her... Because she does Notting Hill and Runaway Bride in a couple years.
Ah, that's right.
So this is her run of, like... Of rom-coms before they, you know...
Yeah, this is
start
her...
To get, there's an, before
I can lead a movie that people want to see. Yeah. Consider Me for Your Next Big Blockbuster Hit so I can win an Oscar. But yeah, my best friend's wedding. Simple concept of a guy and a girl who have been best friends for all these years. He gets engaged, and she starts to realize that maybe there's some feelings that I didn't realize. Yeah. And hijinks happen.
Yeah.
Rupert Everett plays her now gay best friend. Dermot Mulroney plays the now engaged lifelong best friend.
Yeah.
And Cameron Diaz is his new fiance. And yeah.
This one's still well thought of, right? I feel like I hear about this.
It's considered one of the best romantic comedies of all time.
Yeah. Alright, I need to check it out. I'm not anti-rom-com. I just think that most of them are bad. Because that's true.
No, this one...
But this is one that gets...
This one's, you know, a believable one. Everybody can find themselves in the situation at some point in their lifetime of questioning the feelings they have for their friend.
Who hasn't made an agreement with their friend to be like, eh, if we don't get married by this point.
Yeah, and that was the thing. Yeah,
we'll just get married and then hate each other in 10 years.
Yeah, good movie. I'm trying to think of who else was in it. All I can think of right now is Say a Little Prayer for You, because that's a song that they sing at a dinner table, and Rupert Everett just kind of takes over. And
some of the other cast members. You got
What's her name from?
Rachel Griffiths.
Rachel Griffith, thank you.
Kerry Preston was in it. Paul Giamatti's in it.
Oh, that's right.
As a bellman. It's one of those probably uncredited.
You got Danny
Masterson. Yeah, like, nobody really. Yeah, he wasn't a guy.
Yeah,
is he in it or is his little brother?
Who?
Masterson.
Yeah, it was Christopher.
That's
Christopher
right.
Masterson was the young kid.
I've got moves you've never seen. Brian Dennehy? No.
No, Emmett Walsh.
That's right.
Love Emmett Walsh.
So I remember this is the one that has the climax at Comiskey Park.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it was always a fun one for the sports fan as well.
Yeah, baseball.
It has a god-awful karaoke performance by Cameron Diaz, who she like sings all nervously.
Oh, there's another movie. There's a weird movie with her and...
Christine Applegate?
No. her and... It's probably from around the same time or close to it. And fucking, who's the pretty guy from Trainspotting?
Ewan McGregor.
Yeah, I don't know why I couldn't remember his name.
He wasn't exactly pretty in Trainspotting.
No, but nobody was. But like, yeah. But yeah, what a handsome man. But the there's a weird movie where they're getting like chased by angels. Very bizarre movie. It's not very good, but it's interesting. But there's a scene, I think, where she sings in that's really also very funny and horrific.
I've often wondered if Cameron Diaz can actually sing, because any time that she's had to sing in movies, it's not been good.
It's like perfect, but you're like thinking maybe it's purposely bad, because that's the funny
maybe
thing.
Maybe that's where she is an
award-winning. A Life Less Ordinary.
A Life Less Weird movie.
That's what that one was.
Very weird movie.
Yeah, because you started talking about other movies with her, and like the first one that came to mind, I can't think of the title of it, but it was her and Matt Dillon.
That was...
Something About Mary.
No.
Is Matt Dillon in Something About Mary?
Or not Matt Dillon. Was it Keanu Reeves?
Keanu Reeves. That was the...
Dana Aykroyd?
The Feeling Minnesota.
That's what it was.
But yeah. My Best Friend's Wedding.
Highly recommend it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
I'll put it on the next time I'm sick or hungover. I'll find My Best Friend's Wedding. That seems like a good lay in the bed.
Where's the alcohol? We'll be drunk tonight.
No, I gotta work early.
Well, let's talk some great American bash.
Gabby.
Video package starts with an American flag overlay, monuments, and highlights of our competitors with narration. America, land of the free, home of the brave, and the site of the great American bash. The American worker is the backbone of our country.
Yeah.
Diamond Dallas Page has realized the American dream through his dedication and determination to his sport. His vigilance and hard work has thrust him into the spotlight, gaining the attention of the NWO and Macho Man Randy Savage, defining himself in a continuing struggle as another chapter unfolds in Savage Page 2.
Savage Page 2, y'all!
I do love that they're like, it's Savage Page 2, and it's like, yeah, that makes it feel like it means something. And then obviously it does.
Tony Schiavone welcomes everyone to the show, joined by Dusty Rhodes and Bobby the Brain Heenan.
And guys, this set is awesome. I love this set. I like this pay-per-view set.
Mm-hmm.
It feels fresh, feels new, it looks great, it's not too extravagant. You got one long monitor, two
side video boards.
Yeah, side video boards, and then it's draped in fucking American flags to the left and right, and behind it with a big hanging Great American Bash logo. Just real classy, classy setup.
I don't know if anyone caught it, but Tony says this is the 13th Great American Bash, but he's incorrect because there was not one in 93 and 94, and he just doesn't know how to...
He didn't have Wikipedia.
He counted years instead of actual shows.
Yeah. Damn it, Tony.
Our commenters then preview the matches with the Brain saying the Outsiders are in for a fight for their life, while Dusty calls Macho Man and DDP mirror images of each other, and something has to give.
I mean, we love Dusty, but we've been up and down on him on commentary, and that's good shit.
Yes.
It makes complete sense. It's spelling it all out. That's the voice of a booker.
So we go to our first match, Psychosis with Sonny Ono versus Ultimo Dragon in a special respect challenge match.
And you know what this means. Mike Tenay joins the commentator.
I was like, Kevin Sullivan is naming matches again.
But we do have a little story behind this match.
Of course.
Ultimo had quit Sonny after our last pay-per-view, if you remember.
Yeah.
Ono kicked him. And
it's been a good angle.
Yep. Sonny went looking for an instrument of destruction against his former client, bringing in Psychosis to beat some respect into Dragon. Why it's a special respect.
Respect.
Challenge. Yeah, yeah, no, I get it. I mean, they didn't have to tell us that. We watched it happen. But for the person that may have just bought a pay-per-view and doesn't watch regularly, maybe they needed to know.
So our two competitors trade takedowns and mat wrestling, but anytime Ultimo seems to have the advantage, Psychosis rolls out to regroup. Dragon gets caught on a leapfrog with a right hand, but then he catches Psychosis with an elbow on a drop-down while the two are running the ropes.
Nice.
Ultimo with a handstand dropkick from the top rope and goes into a kick combo that again sends Psychosis out to the floor.
Yeah, and that we've been... Ultimo Dragon has been featured, and Psychosis has been featured for less of time, but like, people actually care. Mm-hmm. Ultimo Dragon is getting cheers. There was times where we saw Ultimo Dragon and no one cared, but you just keep pushing him down his throat and let him do his thing, and what are they going to do? Think he stinks? What are they, crazy?
Back in, Dragon nails the spinning rack attack, but he then telegraphs a back body drop, allowing Psychosis to deliver a clothesline into a corner and a dropkick. Psychosis then charges at Ultimo on the ropes, only to be back body dropped out to the apron, where Dragon snaps his neck across the top, causing Psychosis to fall out to the floor. And Ultimo goes for a slingshot plancha, but Psychosis avoids, opening the door for Ono to kick him as the ref is distracted in the ring.
Boo!
Dragon is then hit with a baseball slide before being straddled across the middle rope, followed by a top rope leg drop from Psychosis.
This is a spot that needs to die. It always takes me out of it when a guy's like hanging on the middle rope or a top rope or whatever for so long that you're like, dude, just drop down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it always takes me out of it. Like, either it looks
drop down
pretty
or
cool,
sit up, one
but
or the
yeah,
other.
It always takes longer than you expect it to. Like, it's obviously cool, but it's not. I mean, it happens to this day. Like, when like Omega and Ospreay are doing it, I'm like, it's just taking too long. Just so you know.
They return to the ring, where Ultimo is worked over with elbows, backbreakers, and a Lao Mestrel cradle for a two count, before being tossed out to the floor, where Sonny tries to interfere again, but Dragon counters and goes for a suplex, when Psychosis would leap over the ropes with a slingshot double axe handle to save his manager. Now back in the ring, Ultimo floats over a back body drop and lands some more kicks, followed by a handspring back elbow. And the two start running the ropes with Dragon trying a monkey flip, only for Psychosis to turn it into a pinning sequence, with them rolling their way to the ropes, where the momentum sends Psychosis out to the floor. Ultimo then follows out with an Aussie Eye moonsault, before bringing Psychosis back in to deliver a brainbuster and a tombstone piledriver for a near fall.
And has it been mentioned in our podcast before that name was his, or the moonsault is named after him? I didn't know that until I heard Tony say it, that the acai is his namesake.
I mean, they've said it before. Yeah. Because
I had to look it up, that's his actual last name.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
They may have said it before, too, but I did definitely made note of it this time, where they're like, oh, cool.
It's like that, you know, O'Connor roll that I thought was O'Connor, but it's O'Connor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was one of those that was just named after somebody from all those years ago, but not realizing that, nope, it's his.
Yeah.
Dragon's whip is reversed, sending him to a corner, where he back body drops Psychosis over to the apron, only for him to fly back in with a top rope wheel kick that sends Ultimo out to the floor. Psychosis then dives over the post with a tope suicida, before dragging Dragon back in, where they run the ropes, only for Ultimo to nail a hurricanrana, which leads to both men getting multiple two counts. Dragon then reverses a whip, sending Psychosis to a corner, where he leaps up and moonsaults back. But Ultimo meets him mid-air with a dropkick.
Ah, love to see it.
Dragon then follows up with a super Frankensteiner. But Ono jumps on the apron to distract Ultimo, allowing Psychosis to climb to the top to deliver a missile dropkick for a near fall. Sunny climbs to the apron again, wanting to hit another kick. But it backfires as Dragon reverses the whip, causing Psychosis to take the blow and stumbling backwards into Ultimo locking on a Dragon sleeper for the submission and the win.
And, this is good stuff, and it's just nice to see the crowd be trained into caring about these guys. Yeah, well, recognizing quality, but caring about these guys that they, you know, we've watched and commented on them being like, it's like, this is good. This is better than a lot of the things that you see, but it's American wrestling. Personality is very important.
Yep. I mean, if you think back 6 months or more when it was Psychosis and Rey Mysterio having their little bouts, I want to say on a couple of them, the audience was like super dead silent, and now they're catching on that this shit's good.
Yep.
Post-match, Ono enters the ring and looks to attack. But Ultimo stands his ground, so Sonny just grabs Psychosis to pull him out of the ring instead. Don't want none of that.
No.
Tony then sends us backstage, where we see Chris Benoit on WCWWrestling.com answering questions. And a fan asks how the Crippler will counteract the dungeon interference. So he responds that it's always an issue, but hopes tonight it will be man on man instead of man on dungeon.
Cool. The that kid on the laptop had to have been like fucking 15.
So we go to our second match. Harlem Heat of Booker T and Stevie Ray with Sister Sherry.
Sister.
Versus the Steiner brothers of Rick and Scott Steiner.
Steiner.
In a number one contenders match for the WCW World Tag Team Championships. Stevie starts off with Scott, with the two trading forearms, hip tosses, shoulder blocks, back elbows, and big boots. Stevie Ray tries for another big boot, but Steiner ducks this time and nails an exploder suplex, before hitting a clothesline to both Harlem Heat members, forcing them to regroup. Stevie returns to the ring and calls for Rick to come in, and those two men trade strikes, only for Steiner to nail a power slam, followed by Scott hitting a clothesline on Booker when he runs in, again sending Harlem Heat out to regroup. Booker T then tags in, and he asks for a test of strength. With Scott.
I don't know about that idea there.
And Steiner even gets a good chuckle out of it.
Yeah. Like, you see these things attached to my torso?
Like how we were just talking last week about how Scott has gotten extra swole and pumped.
Absolutely. Vascular.
But Booker hits a knee to the gut, allowing him to apply a side headlock. Only for Steiner to attempt a back suplex, which Booker T floats over and locks in a full Nelson. But Scott powers his way out, only for another knee that allows Booker to continue the attack, until a telegraphed back body drop allows Steiner to nail a Tiger Bomb.
Yeah!
and Rick comes in, but he has his eyes raked. So Booker T tries for a suplex, only for Steiner to reverse it into one of his own for a two count. Scott's back in for a gorilla press slam and a second rope elbow drop, only for Booker to get a boot up to the chin. Spinneroonies up and delivers a Harlem sidekick. Booker T then hits a clothesline that sends them both to the floor, where they brawl before returning to the ring, where Scott delivers an elbow drop for a near fall. Rick tags in, but a reversed whip sends him towards Stevie Ray, knocking him down to the floor, followed by Booker tossing Steiner out as well. Stevie power slams Rick on the floor, followed by a clothesline, before rolling Steiner back in so Booker T can make the cover for a two count. And Stevie Ray tags in to keep up the attack with a high knee. Booker snaps his neck across the ropes for a near fall, followed by a double team sidekick variation of a heart attack, all on Rick. Booker T continues with more strikes. He goes for a spinning heel kick, only for Rick to catch and drop him with a suplex, making the crawl to the corner for the
hot tag.
Scott cleans house with slams and suplexes until all four men are brawling, with Rick and Stevie making their way to the floor, while Scott lands a Super Frankensteiner on Booker. All of a sudden, the NWO's Vincent comes running down, jumps in the ring, and drops an elbow on Booker T in front of the ref.
Yep.
Causing a disqualification.
Bum, bum, bum.
Making Harlem Heat the number one contender. Post-match.
Shall you add some heat, I guess? I mean, right in front of the ref is funny. Like, I was like, no way that they don't ring the bell. And then he did, and I was like, all right, well, this is just Vincent fucking with him, which is funny and will get people actually upset, like me.
Post-match, Booker's happy that they won, but Stevie Ray doesn't like how it happened.
No, not at all.
Vincent then gets caught by the Steiners, tossing him back into the ring for multiple Steiner lines, ripping his shirt off, and then dropped by a Steinerizer. We haven't seen one of those in a while.
No, we haven't. This match was kind of fine. It was a little sloppy. And, like, Harlem Heat are large guys, but they're not very quick.
No.
The Steiners are really fast for their size, and Harlem Heat can't keep up and keep it crisp. But still, pro Booker and Stevie Ray over here.
And old Vincent, he's been Steinerized.
I mean, he deserved it.
Yeah. R.I.P., mister.
So we go to our third match. Conan versus Hugh Morris.
And Hugh Morris's chin nub? My God, what an awful look. He's got like the smallest amount of chin hair and somehow got a rubber band around it. Insane looking.
Hugh yells, "Aw, shucky ducky."
Yeah, I heard that, and
what is
I
that?
Had to laugh. It eventually becomes a Booker T.
Oh,
yeah, Booker T starts saying it. It won't...
Shucky ducky quack quack.
Don't remember shucky ducky quack quack.
Yeah, it's years later when he gets on commentary that.
Oh.
It's something he says often. He even did like a pre-show, whatever, the shucky ducky quack quack moment of the whatever show.
Oof. Sounds like a children's television show.
Who knew? It all came from Hugh.
Yeah.
But we also learned that the broken broomstick from the Nitro that we watched last week
was from Hugh Morris.
Was payback from Hugh onto Conan.
So. And it meant so much that we didn't even get to see it on television.
And see, I'm not going to lie, when it happened, I thought, all right, Raven's done with ECW.
Oh.
This is going to be his sneak way into WCW, because I couldn't remember how he ends up transitioning into WCW, and I thought, all right, yeah, just go after Conan, because I can't remember. I remember Conan had his like little crossover in ECW for a minute, but I couldn't remember if him and Raven had any beef.
They did not.
Cap.
Because Raven was champion. Well, actually, they probably had a match. Conan's last match in ECW was probably with Raven, possibly.
Can't remember.
It was either him or Shane Douglas. I don't remember which one.
Yeah. Probably Shane Douglas, because Conan can work.
So our two competitors trade clotheslines, drop kicks, and right hands till the fight spills to the floor, when Conan runs Morris into the steel steps before returning to the ring.
Something I noticed on this show, they start saying lariat instead of clothesline. Like Tony Schiavone even. And it's like, oh, are they just trying to sound different than WWF?
Class of the jaw.
It gets used. I was like, oh, they don't say clothesline on this show once. It was just interesting. Small, inconsequential thing, but seemed like it was pointed.
Conan with a drop kick and a rolling clothesline for a two count, before beginning to wear down Hugh with a rear chin lock, followed by more drop kicks and locking in a modified STF until Morris can make the ropes. They head off to the floor once again, with Conan being rammed into the steps.
Payback!
Turn to the ring, where Hugh nails a spinning heel kick for a near fall, followed by applying an armbar and delivering a gut-wrench suplex for a two count. Morris then telegraphs a back body drop, allowing Conan to kick him down and attempting a stump puller. But Hugh's just too big for it, so Conan transitions into a head scissors and a cross arm breaker to keep the pressure on.
Yeah, and this isn't bad, but this is an early piss match because, like I said a minute ago about Psychosis and Ultimo Dragon, it's like, you made him mean something, but Hugh Morris and Conan don't really feel like they mean anything. Like
Conan doesn't really even know what he means yet, so yeah. none of the rest of us could.
Yeah, because I don't think this is bad, but nobody cares.
Back to their feet, the two trade strikes when they begin to fight over a waistlock, ending with Morris blocking a clothesline attempt and going back to an armbar, only for Conan to kick him away. Hugh then reverses a whip, sending Conan to the corner where he leaps up and over a charging Morris, pulling him over into an O'Connor roll for a near fall. And Hugh rakes the eyes and nails a power slam, heads up top for no laughing matter. But Conan finally makes it back to his feet to trip up Morris, allowing him to hit a German suplex, followed by locking on the tequila sunrise for the ref stoppage
and the win.
I couldn't be happier that he didn't go for that no laughing matter, because maybe a minute or two before they got to that spot, both of these men were visibly winded.
Oh, that's why they kept going to the
gassed.
The rest spots.
Yeah.
I mean, even the commentators called them out on it at one point. I was just like,
yeah, because like it started pretty good and they're big guys, but like they got, yeah, they were winded. You could,
yeah,
it looked like some for your computer, you know, wasn't running the video game very well. And when there are too many enemies got on screen, they just like visibly slowed down in such a noticeable way. So I'm glad that Hugh Morris didn't die trying to do a moonsault.
True.
I mean, they were so winded it took Conan an extra 10 seconds to...
Yeah. There was a really funny like whip spot where one of them got stopped and they were just like confused. Like, I'm not getting enough blood to my brain.
And see, this was the Conan that I was kind of introduced to back in WCW, which was why years later when everybody was talking about Conan, I never could understand why anybody gave a shit about Conan. Cause...
Now you do, because we've seen good...
Yeah.
We've seen Conan like buff as hell and... really impressive.
We've seen the many stages of Conan, but this is definitely not my favorite.
I mean, yeah, not honestly, not too many years after this, he looks like a potato.
Mm-hmm.
And now he looks like a potato.
With his top button buttoned.
With eyes. Or is that what's called? Potatoes grow eyes, right? Little things. That's what they call them, yeah.
We go to Mean Gene on the stage, and he plugs the hotline, saying that someone might show up tomorrow in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
A man that is having issues with his current organization.
Mm-hmm.
And he is talking about Raven,
mm-hmm.
but they do delay his debut for a few weeks.
Oh. They're like, oh, you didn't really work over there at mm-hmm. all, did you?
Nope, I was only champion for 12 mm-hmm. years.
Yeah, I mostly had crutches and like sat.
Okerlund then introduces Public Enemy, who we haven't seen since Spring Stampede 97, episode 248.
Yay.
And they bring out a table.
I can't believe this. The crowd is actually doing the hand wave. I felt like Public Enemy was a foregone conclusion at this point, but people are doing it. Why? I don't know.
It's something to do.
Mm-hmm.
Good point. I've been to wrestling shows. Sometimes people just say things to say them.
Yeah, it's their way of, you know, participating with Public Enemy while also, like, waving goodbye to Conan.
It's a twofer.
Public Enemy sets the table up so that all three of our gentlemen can sit on it to have a chat. And Mean Gene asks why they are there, with Rocco saying that he's overwhelmed and exasperated, that his flippidimus is flipped. It's like a Saturday night on South Street in Philly.
I do love this version of Rocco where he's like, what if Pauly Shore was on pills? Like, downers, I guess, and not uppers. But yeah, it's like, oh, he's being goofy, but he's getting his words out and they make sense. And the ones that don't make sense are not supposed to make sense.
Flippididymus.
Flippididymus.
Oakland then claims everyone is asking questions about them. I actually wonder if this is true or not.
I mean,
why are you here?
Yeah, it's exactly what I'm saying.
But Rock questions why Harlem Heat's the number one contender, while Grunge just acts confused. So Rocco whacks him with his hat and calls him stupid. Johnny then says he wants to party, but Rock has more to say, claiming that the office is ignoring them and they are not afraid of Harlem Heat. Grunge emphasizes this by yelling, I'm afraid of Harlem Heat.
Not!
That's where they lose it, because this is actually a really good promo, I think, for these guys that, like, were pretty over at this point. I thought that it was pretty well performed.
Not.
I tell you, I mean, I set it up.
Before the two proceed to have a dance party into the crowd.
There's the Public Enemy, I know.
It's a good 5 minute.
Yeah, all I'm saying
to set up the next.
Yeah,
match.
All I'm saying is that they are trying, and it's the most promo we've seen on them in WCW.
It's the only promo we've seen from them in WCW.
And they did. I don't think they flubbed it. I don't know that it's the greatest, like, way to attack.
It's no teaching Mikey Whipwreck to get the beer.
No, of course not. It's not. Nothing's that good. But it was nice to see them try and get the opportunity, even if they're not my favorite guys.
So we go to our fourth match, Wrath with Mortis and James Vandenberg versus Glacier. And the story behind this match was that Vandenberg and his cronies had continued to interfere in Glacier's matches.
They stole his special helmet!
So J.J. Dillon had announced that Mortis would be handcuffed to the ring post for this matchup.
Ooh.
I do love that they're like, oh, Glacier was the son of a police officer. It's like, and now he's a Mortal Kombat guy? Like, don't tell me his dad was a cop if this guy's going to come out here looking like Sub-Zero. Just don't say anything at all. It means more.
Yeah.
And because this
don't
is such
humanize
an important
him.
Matchup.
Yeah.
Yes.
You guys know that I'm a bigger fan of this very stupid shit.
Than I am.
Yeah.
Yes.
I understand why you guys hate. I just don't think it's obviously very dumb, but I like that it's just kind of a different. It's like, yeah, it's the moon that is, like, out, like, that you can see from the planet that is WCW, where it's just like, oh, yeah, it's up there. It happens every day, but, like, nobody really ever thinks about it.
And see, I'm trying to figure out if 19-year-old Shane or 46-year-old Shane hated it more, because both of us got to watch it.
Yeah.
But, like I said, it's so important. Mike Today's back at the commentary booth for this one.
Which makes no sense.
Are we going to get a Huda Kanrata?
Because he's the only one that probably knows the martial art moves.
Oh, I guess so.
Yeah, you got Dusty.
Professor. Come on.
I know he's the professor, but neither of these guys are Mexican or Japanese, so it seems silly.
Dusty's going to call it some sort of a...
Yeah.
Twinkle, twinkle, baby.
Yeah. A Bruce Lee in this motherfucker.
Elbows, kicks, and chops are traded. Until Glacier dropkicks Wrath out of the ring, following out with a slingshot plancha. Vandenberg then distracts the Cold One, allowing Wrath to regroup and ram Glacier into a railing. But a reversed whip sends Wrath into the steel steps. Back in the ring, the Cold One misses a corner splash as Mortis moves Wrath in time, allowing the big man to take control with a hot shot across the top rope. Wrath then applies a chin lock to wear down Glacier. But he breaks free and misses a crossbody, sending him crashing out to the floor. Wrath capitalizes with a cannonball off the apron before nailing a flying clothesline back inside the ring for a two count. and Wrath just starts slapping Glacier, only for him to retaliate with a choke. But it's not enough as the big man hits a backbreaker and attempts a pump elbow drop, which the cold one avoids and rallies with a back body drop and a jumping back elbow for a near fall. Wrath counters with a side slam and he climbs to the top, when Glacier would tumble into the ref, sending him into the ropes, causing the big man to crotch himself.
Ref bump.
The cold one delivers a superplex, but Mortis jumps on the apron to cause a distraction, allowing Wrath to regroup and nail a back suplex. Vandenberg then climbs on the apron, so Mortis tosses a chain into the ring. However, it goes over the head of Wrath, allowing Glacier to pick it up for a chain-aided fist to the big man, while Vandenberg has stolen the handcuff key from the ref.
Mortis has a bit of a tough time.
James rushes to get Mortis unlocked, but to no avail, as the cold one makes the cover for the pin
and the win.
Mortis attacks with the handcuffs, attaching Glacier to the ropes, allowing Wrath and Mortis to beat him down until officials can arrive to stop the attack.
Oh no.
There was an interesting thing here that Tony Schiavone points out that Nick Patrick is the ref and that he's back from suspension and he's doing a good job, which scared me for this show where I was like, when is Nick Patrick going to turn? But it was a nice tease for keep you on your toes. And you point out, it's like, oh, it's Nick Patrick and he's calling it by the ball. But this, if these were just two guys and one of them like stole the other guy's wife or their ex-tag team partners, this would have been good. It was well worked and everything. It's that they look like fucking cartoon characters. It's the same reason that like, yeah, the dinosaur in AEW is a big guy and he's not a terrible worker, but he's also a dinosaur. So like, he's dressed up like a dinosaur and he's an adult man. Like it's, yeah. There's a fine line in wrestling when you do shit like that.
So we go to our fifth match. Akira Hokuto with Sunny Ono versus Medusa for the WCW Women's World Championship in a title versus career match.
Oh my god. And for some reason, Lee Marshall joins commentary.
What do you mean, some reason?
He's our ladies expert.
Is he?
You bring in Mike Tanay for the Japanese matches? You bring in old Lee Marshall for the ladies. Oh,
yeah, he's the ladies.
For the ladies.
But the champion came out first.
Foreshadowing.
And Akira spits on and slaps Medusa to start, using hair-based offense and chokes to gain control, before stretching her on the ropes and nailing a pile driver. Medusa rallies after being tossed to the ropes, coming back with a sling blade and a pair of missile drop kicks for a two count. Medusa's working over Hokuto with jabs in a corner, pouncing on the neck, only for Akira to slow the momentum by grabbing Medusa by the throat, allowing her to deliver more chokes and several suplexes for a near fall.
And the crowd is into this, so sorry about you, Conan and Morris and Mortis.
Wrath.
And Wrath and Glacier.
Hokuto then goes for a spinning toe hold, biting at the boot, when Medusa fires up with multiple kicks and a snapmare, only for Akira to counter with an inside cradle for a two count. Medusa's sent to a corner, only to flip over to the apron, where she delivers a boot to the face of Hokuto, following up with a top rope double axe handle, but she hurts her knee in the process. So Akira goes right after the hurt limb with a shin breaker, a surfboard, and a Northern Lights suplex, before heading up top, where Medusa hobbles her way over for a headstand head scissors and a powerbomb for the pin, and no, Hokuto kicks out.
The big pain, ass powerbomb. What a big powerbomb.
The pain is too much for Medusa, so Akira is able to place her opponent on the top rope for a superplex for a near fall, followed by locking on a leg bar, forcing a screaming Medusa to make the ropes to break the hold. Back on their feet, Hokuto goes to the top for a missile dropkick, only for Medusa to avoid and deliver a bridging German for the pin. And no, Sonny Ono pulls Medusa's legs out from under her.
Son of a bitch. Exactly.
Akira attacks the leg again, standing on it, punching at it, before hitting a scoop slam and heading up top for a splash. But Medusa gets her knees up, which just puts her into more pain.
Yeah, I mean, I get the idea behind that, but you got an injured knee. I don't know if that's the right move for you.
I want to give some props to Hokuto here. She milks every five count as she does something illegal to Medusa down on the mat. Like, everybody, if you're a heel, you should be breaking at five and then just going back to it. But she really sells getting as much out of every one of those seconds as she possibly can.
Yep.
Medusa makes it to her feet and nails a clothesline for a two count. Lifts Hokuto for a back suplex, only for the knee to give. Allowing Akira to nail a Northern Lights bomb.
She sees her moment.
For the pin.
And the win.
That nasty Northern suplex bomb looks like a brain buster. I don't know what these ladies are doing. Medusa was serving, if I can use that word, Charlotte Flair vibes in this match.
Yes, and as the kids would say, she ate that Northern Lights bomb.
Oh, absolutely.
Post-match, Hokuto continues attacking the leg after the bell, including biting it until the ref is able to get her to leave. And Lee can't believe Medusa's career is over, while Heenan finds it hilarious, saying, good news is she won't be standing in an unemployment line with that leg.
Fuck. So brutal. Because, like, we all like Medusa, and we feel like we haven't seen enough of her, and this is maybe the best match we've seen her have? Potentially?
I mean, in WCW, yeah.
Yeah, and this is...
They typically put her against people who don't know how to wrestle, or it's just, you know, a three-minute something where it's her chasing Paul Heyman around the ring, and or a bikini contest with Missy.
And this is the best Hokuto match, too. Like, this is great, and she is a perfect heel in this match. Mm-hmm. Perfect, intelligent heel.
And she had that look, like I was talking about on the last episode, where it's like Marilyn Manson inspired, where she's wearing this funky gas mask, and
she looks like a murderer.
Yep.
And she is.
Officials help Medusa out of the ring when Mean Gene tries to get a word, asking her if she understands the gravity of her career being over.
There was an uncaring moment for Gene, this is him in full display, because it was... She was like
crying. Her knees are just fucking ruined.
He put the mean in Mean Gene in this little segment here.
She yells at him, not now, while fans start chanting, leave her alone. Leave her alone.
Yeah, it's like, is this the last match for Medusa? Because no one's... Like, people have liked her and loved her, and no one's ever been like, get her out of here, but like, this is the most it feels like any crowd's ever given her.
Oakland doesn't even understand why they're chanting it. It's like, I'm just doing my job. Like, no, you're being a heartless bastard.
Yeah, in my notes it says, this is the meanest of genes. Because we're all on the same page here. I don't even remember writing that, but it's a weird and sad end. It's a weird and sad end of a match, but it's such a good match.
Mm-hmm.
So this will be the last time we see Medusa for a couple of years. And the last we see of the WCW Women's Championship
ever. Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, honestly, I would put this on a potential short list. Potential. Just because it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, you remember. I was the only one that was like, we got to put the Ultimo versus... Liger.
Oh yeah.
2-minute match on the short list.
Uh-huh.
And there it ended up.
Yeah.
So we go to our sixth match. Chris Benoit versus Ming with Jimmy Hart in a return death match.
So I assume Chris Benoit is working through Doom to get to Sullivan?
The dungeon, yeah.
Yeah, Dungeon of Doom.
So the story behind this match was that Jimmy Hart had told the Crippler that he had to face the Faces of Fear to get to Kevin Sullivan. So Benoit tapped out Barbarian on a Nitro. And then Hart said that the Crippler had to defeat Ming in a death match, which he had lost to, at Slamboree in the same kind of match to Ming.
This is Chris Benoit, Ming, 2.
Right. Why weren't they part of the advertising? Because match gets my blood pumping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Totes.
So as Ming makes it to ringside, Benoit flies out of the ring with a tope suicida, chasing Jimmy to the back before returning his attention to the Tongan to work over the arm. In the ring, the Crippler nails a flying headbutt and applies a crossface, only for Ming to escape by lifting Benoit up to a turnbuckle, followed by press slamming him off to the mat.
Yeah, he just stands up and sets him down like a child in a high chair and press slams him to the mat. It's great.
Does he do an airplane?
Yeah, he does an airplane. He feeds it to him.
The Crippler drop kicks the knees a pair of times, goes for a figure four, but Ming rolls over to escape. So Benoit just transitions into another crossface, causing the Tongan to grab the ropes to break the hold. And at this point I went, hey, it's a death match, so there shouldn't be any rope breaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's...
But I digress.
But I think this is a, like, 10-count death match, but they still use the other rules?
Yes.
Yeah.
It appears so.
I mean, that's what I picked up.
Ming fires up with right hands and a roundhouse kick. He goes for a powerbomb, which Benoit floats over and runs the ropes, sliding out to the floor and tripping up his opponent, before attempting to suplex him over. But the Tongan holds onto the ropes, causing both men to crash out.
Yeah, and it looks like they're like, oh, Ming got the worst of it. And I'm like, no, guys, I watched it. He basically turns Chris over and drops him across the top rope. And they both fall over, but Chris got the worst of it.
Back in the ring, the Crippler heads up top, but a kick from Ming causes Benoit to fall into a tree of woe.
Whoa.
Allowing the Tongan to work him over with kicks. Back to his feet, the Crippler gets into a chop fight, only to be tossed to the ropes and dropped with a spine buster and a dragon sleeper before they start chopping each other again. Benoit reverses a whip, but charges into a knee, allowing Ming to climb the ropes for a top rope splash for the pin. And no, there are no covers in a death match. The Crippler makes it back to his feet at the count of 7, only for Ming to thrust kick him out of the ring, where the Tongan follows out to continue the punishment, but Benoit counters by sending Ming into a guardrail. They return to the ring where the Crippler delivers several German suplexes and kicks that force Ming to roll out to regroup. But Ming returns to absorb some punches and hit an atomic drop before locking on the Tongan death grip. But Benoit escapes by leaping over the ropes to the floor, so Ming follows out for the two men to trade strikes. And they make it back inside where Ming keeps up the attack with knees, snapmares, and a reverse chinlock, followed by a back suplex. He then heads up top for a splash, only for the Crippler to move in time.
Nobody home.
Benoit takes Ming down back into a crossface with the Tongan reaching the ropes, only for the Crippler to take him right back down into another crossface. But this time they're in the ropes. And Ming starts clubbering and attempts the Tongan death grip. But Benoit ducks and locks in the crossface again in the middle of the ring. Ming tries to make the crawl, but he begins to fade, and he lightly taps out for the submission and the win.
Yeah, it looks like he's just kind of passing out.
I think that's what they were going for, but then he like actually kind of like does the tap.
Yeah, and very slowly. He's like,
so did you tap out? Did you
not? Yeah. Like, the finish is a bit of a bummer because it's not very well. It's like, I see where you're coming from, where they were coming from, but it wasn't executed particularly well.
It would have made more sense for him not to tap out.
Mm-hmm. And pass out.
And pass out.
No.
Yep. Otherwise, you know, it's just...
Because then it should have just been a submission.
Involuntary hand twitching. Yeah, because like, guys will like hit the mat like slowly, but when you tap out, you do it quickly. Yep. It's like a different thing.
Because if... That wasn't the most disappointing part of
this. Oh, no. Don't tell me. I know exactly what happened.
Post-match, Officials come out to check on both men, with paramedics placing a neck brace on the crippler before wheeling him out on a stretcher.
Him first?
The trainer then checks on Ming, asking him questions while they wait on another stretcher to come out. But once it does, they load him up. So we did a double stretcher job, basically on a match
that
was just full of submissions.
Mm-hmm. There was no reason for the double, like, and it takes so long. Because they're like, oh, well, it's taking a while because they're probably just going to use the same stretcher. And I'm like, the fuck are you talking about? Like,
if that's the case, then just wheel out the paramedics on the stretcher and have them fix them in the ring.
And if you were going to do the stretcher job, you'd take Ming back first and then Benoit, or you take Ming back. What they should have done, if they were going to do it at all, they start to take Ming back, and then Chris starts to pound on him, knocks him out of the thing. They get separated, and then they bring Ming back again.
Yeah, this whole segment was not well thought out.
No.
It's the only way I can think of it shows their southern roots in this, because you have a foreigner in Benoit and a foreigner in Ming, and so since they're both foreign, they went for the lighter-skinned one first. As sad as it sounds, that's the thought process I went with it, because it's like, WCW.
The South. There was no reason for this to be a stretcher match for either man.
No, it's just dumb.
Yeah.
But maybe that means we're going to get a return death match.
Benoit Ming. 3.
We then go to Mean Gene, who then, as he's starting to talk, freaks out because the paramedics drop the Tongan by accident. But he eventually regains his exposure to wish everyone a happy Father's Day and plug the hotline before we go to a commercial for Bash at the Beach, where we get footage of Okerlund and Heenan partying with some ladies while a narrator says it's time to hit the beach and ride the waves. Yeah, right. Hogan and the NWO's newest bad boy, Dennis Rodman, are gonna crash the bash.
Oh, Rod the Bod is crashing the bash, eh?
I mean, to me, he's the worm. I'm not calling him Rod the Bod. Ew.
So we go to our 7th match. Steve, Mongo McMichael.
Why is this?
With Deborah McMichael versus Kevin Green. So the story behind this match was that Kevin doesn't forgive or forget, remembering what happened to him a year ago. Green would attack Mongo during a match, followed by McMichael confronting Kevin during the middle of a tag match that he was a part of, leaving Jeff Jarrett all alone to fend off their opponents. Double J said it was the last straw, while Mongo would take credit for turning Green's career around, claiming he was owed money for it.
Sure, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
So Kevin rushes the ring and attacks with a slingshot dropkick, forearms, and a 3-point stance clothesline that sends McMichael out to regroup.
I mean, you gotta respect Kevin Green's energy, and he is so much more confident. Like, he has supreme babyface energy here, and he looks like an ass kicker.
And he definitely looks like he belongs more there than Mongo.
Yeah, it's like, oh, this guy's got an it factor. It kind of feels like when like Pat McAfee had that match with Adam Cole, and you're like, holy shit,
yeah,
like this is fucking good. And like, we've seen Kevin Green do what he could at the time, but here it looks like he's taking it seriously. He put in the work, and he looks awesome.
Mongo drags Green out, attacking his leg, ramming it on the apron, and mocking Kevin's family, who's at ringside, causing Mama Green to just smack McMichael with her purse.
I mean, it's pure babyface shit.
Kevin's able to rally, running Mongo into the steps before rolling back in and checking on his family.
I mean, it's so cute. He checks on his mom.
Yep. You okay, Mama? Which allows McMichael to recover and regain control with an elbow drop. Mongo continues the punishment with stomps, a punt kick to the ribs, and a neck breaker for a 2 count. McMichael then whips Green to the ropes, who bounces off with a Fez press, only for Mongo to catch a charging Kevin with a tilt-a-whirl backbreaker. The two trade punches, including green mounted ones in the corner, until McMichael nails a Manhattan drop to slow the momentum. And Mongo hits a drop kick for a near fall, followed by working the leg once again. Stomps and chokes before charging into a big boot, allowing Kevin to climb to the top for a flying forearm for a two count. Green with a clothesline that sends McMichael out to the floor, and he follows out to slam him down as well, when Deborah would distract Kevin momentarily with a fake ankle injury.
Boo!
Allowing Mongo again to regroup.
And Kevin Green, he's serving, as they say, and he checks on, you know, checks on the damsel in distress and getting outsmarted. He hasn't been a wrestler for long enough.
Green goes to re-enter the ring when McMichael would drop an elbow like before, but Kevin outsmarts him this time to avoid.
That was a wonderful moment.
Green whips Mongo to a corner and charges in with a three-point stance, only for McMichael to sidestep it and clobber Kevin down to the mat. And Deborah jumps up on the apron to distract the ref, when Jeff Jarrett would come running down with the briefcase, swinging it right as Green would pull Mongo into the line of fire,
yeah,
allowing Kevin to make the cover for the pin
and the win.
Post-match, Double J leaves in a hurry, leaving Deborah very upset with him, while Green celebrates with his family.
Yeah, it is a good moment where Double J's like, fuck, I fucked up, and just walks to the back instead of like going in to like check on his partner and like faction mate.
Tony then sends us backstage to the training room, where the trainer is checking on Medusa's leg, causing her to cry out in pain as he prods, with Shivani wondering if she will need reconstructive knee surgery.
And this is so weird because it's like they're going to use a stretcher on Benoit and Ming, but then they're just going to stick her in like a fucking broom closet and like poke her knee while she's like, she's selling incredibly well. Like, she looks like she's in pain. She does a great job. It's like, yeah, but what about her?
Yeah,
we believe that she's hurt. We don't believe that these other guys are actually hurt.
This is technically a former employee too. The two that are still employed by the company, they don't really get any medical treatment. They just get dropped off in the back and then dropped on the way to the back, as opposed to the one that just lost her career.
I was going to say, why should we even care if Medusa's hurt or not? Because her career's over.
Yep.
We're never going to see her again.
That's a good point. So if you're going to do this retro,
where's Mean Gene so he can just keep rubbing it in?
Oh my God. You know? Yeah, the meanest.
How's it feel now that your career's over? Does that make your knee hurt a little bit less?
Yeah. Okay. He is the best. We love Mean Gene, but that was one of the few times where I felt negative about him. Mm-hmm. I was like, no. Are you going to join the NWO, you dickhead?
So we get our eighth match, the Outsiders of Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, with six, versus the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, and Roddy Piper, for the WCW World Tag Team Championships.
They call it the first of our two main events. There's only one main event on any show. You can argue that a match should have been the main event, but the last match is the main event. There's no two main events. Give it up.
The champs came out first.
Foreshadowing.
I don't know if I'm going to fall for that one again.
Hall and Nate trade punches and chops until Scott rolls out to regroup.
It took me a second there. I thought you messed up saying Nash. Hall and Nash.
But once back in, Hall whips the Nature Boy into a flare flip out to the apron, where Nash is right there with a big boot to knock Nate down for a two count. Scott with more right hands, and he sends the Nature Boy to the ropes, where Six trips him up, allowing Hall to nail a clothesline for a near fall. Kevin tags in to continue the punishment with knees, elbows, and forearms in a corner.
1 second. Kevin Nash does the suck it to Ric Flair after the two count. And I'm like, is this the first suck it?
He
does the crotch chop right at him.
We don't have a DX yet.
I know. Then I'm like, does that mean that Six took it from Kevin Nash and brought it to the WWF?
No. It appears in WWF before Six reappears.
Yes.
They're still talking
about it. I know, of course. I just thought it was funny because it's like the first visual suck it.
That but we see, now I'm going to have to watch the next Raw just to see if we have a return suck it from...
Oh, yeah. It's
maybe,
like...
Maybe they're sending messages to each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through the episodes.
We're decoding messages here. 25 years later.
Hey, certain crimes aren't solved for, 30, 40 years.
I mean, yeah, of course.
Kevin follows it up with a side slam for a two count before nailing Snake Eyes, leaving Flair wobbly on the ropes. So Scott hits a clothesline from the apron to take Nate down. And Kevin goes to pick up the Nate boy, only for the dirtiest player in the game to go low and make the crawl to the corner for the
hot tag.
That was horrible. Let's try it again.
But it's not that hot of a tag, so maybe we did it right.
Okay, sure. It really wasn't.
It wasn't.
We'll just
no.
leave that in.
Roddy with right hands and eye rakes to everybody before whipping the outsiders into each other, leaving Hall wobbly, so Piper locks on a sleeper until Scott crotches Roddy on the ropes,
no.
leaving everyone laid out. And as Piper makes his way back to his feet, Nash comes in, which brings Flair in as well. So the ref has to get Nate back into his corner, allowing Six to jump in the ring with a roundhouse kick to Roddy's head. And the Nature Boy begins chasing the kid around ringside, brawling their way down the aisle and to the back, leaving Piper alone in the ring.
No.
Reaching out for a tag, but no one's there. Home. Roddy makes a valiant effort, but the outsiders are too much, just beating down Piper, when Kevin would nail a big boot, followed by an outsider's edge from Hall, for the pin.
And the win.
Post-match, Roddy finally makes it to his feet, still wondering where Flair is, leaving the ring in frustration.
I mean, the crowd's full of boos. They're upset that Flair's not there. They're upset that the outsiders won. And, you know, what happened to Rick? So, an interesting angle.
Mm-hmm. So we go to our ninth match. Macho Man, Randy Savage, with Miss Elizabeth. Versus Diamond Dallas Page with Kimberly in a Falls Count Anywhere match. Michael Buffer makes our announcements, so let's get ready to have a grudge match that the history of wrestling has never seen.
Lights out grudge match, a unsanctioned grudge match. It's
Falls Count Anywhere grudge match.
It's Savage Page 2.
So Savage is in the ring when DDP's music hits, but only Kimberly comes out because Paige emerges from the crowd to attack Macho from behind.
So good.
DDP attempts a diamond cutter, but Savage avoids and rolls out to the floor, only for Paige to fly over the ropes with a slingshot crossbody atop him, causing DDP to hurt his ribs, which were already taped, giving Macho an opening. And the brawl continues around ringside when Savage would hide behind Liz. So Paige would move her and nail Macho with multiple clotheslines back inside the ring.
Get out of here, bitch!
I was trying to remember what he called her.
Yeah, he called her a bitch. He said, get out of here, bitch.
So I remember him saying something, and all I could think of was, damn, stop being so mean to Liz.
But yeah, people call things a grudge match, but this one looks and feels like a grudge match.
It's almost like he has a grudge on her, or against her, too.
Yeah. I mean, the energy is...
She made fun of Kimberly, too.
Well, she made fun of Kimberly, and I guess she did slam a car door on his shoulder.
But the energy is actually palpable, and, like, there's that great moment where DDP, like, stands in excitement after, like, putting Macho out on the floor, but then, like, he immediately sells his ribs, and it's like, oh, yeah, the adrenaline isn't strong enough to make up for a cracked or broken rib.
DDP tosses Savage over the ropes to the floor, following out for the fight to spill into the crowd, where Paige is not so rubber band slammed on a guardrail.
Take that, you motherfucker.
DDP retaliates by ramming Macho into a wall and a door before grabbing a crutch from a fan and breaking it over Savage's back.
Ouch.
I mean, yeah. This is a good visual brawl.
They brawl their way back to ringside, where Macho throws Paige into the steel steps, followed by throwing powder into his face once back in the ring, allowing Savage to attack with a plastic sign.
It's like, yeah, it's like a sign I saw earlier in the night that a fan had, and it's just like a weird circle that says DDP, like spray painted on it. But I don't know what it's made out of.
Okay.
I mean, it just kind of like shatters, but I couldn't tell if it was like if it was actually like sugar glass or
it's, it's either sugar glass or they like, you know, baked some plastic. It was a shrinky dink. Originally, it was had a 4 foot diameter, and then they put it in the oven, and it got, you know, 12 inch diameter, but it became more brittle.
Macho works the ribs, ripping the tape off of Paige, which concerns the ref. So he starts to admonish Savage, only for Mickey J to just get punched and pile-driven for his efforts.
Damn. I mean, ref bump, my God. Yeah. They fucking really gave it to him. Also, it looks great, and Mickey J is not the thinnest of guys, so it's like, damn. You're gonna pile-drive the fat ref?
Tuck down the big boy.
Yeah.
A new ref, Mark Curtis, comes running down as Macho continues the punishment on DDP. Only for Savage to just throw him through the ropes, where the distraction allows Paige to recover momentarily.
I mean, ref bump number two, guys.
But DDP charges into a big boot in a corner, followed by a clothesline for Macho to take the fight back out to the floor. Savage begins to intimidate Kimberly, when Nick Patrick would run out to protect her, giving Paige more time to recover, this time to take the fight down the aisle and towards a VIP picnic area.
But I got nervous when Nick Patrick came out because they teased it earlier, and I was like, is Nick Patrick going to do some dirty shit?
Is he really a changed man?
Is he NWO?
And the two men break the wooden railings. DDP breaks a platter over Macho's head, slams him through a wooden table before dumping the charcoal from a grill onto Savage.
I do love that, like, this is a little goofy, this, like, weird fake picnic area. It's like next to the like entrance stage or whatever, but at least they had people there, so it looks like maybe it was like a VIP thing or whatever, and then they went over there and those people fled and then they used it. So it's like, silly as it may be, they at least presented it like it existed, as opposed to like the popcorn like concession, fake concession stand from Harlem Heat and Public Enemy. Like,
it's their way of mocking the in your house theme, you know?
Yeah.
WCW at your picnic.
DDP then chokes Macho as they head back to the ring with his t-shirt. But once they're in the ring, Paige charges in, with Macho getting a boot up. But DDP slides underneath to the floor, tripping up Savage to crotching on the ring post.
Post it.
Paige with a pancake, and he calls for the finish. But Macho nails a jawbreaker that sends DDP stumbling out to the floor, where Savage throws him into the steel steps and exposes the concrete floor.
You know, those floor mats are only held together by Velcro.
I do love that that pancake that DDP cooked up. It just kind of looked like a sloppy Styles Clash, because it like wasn't like a straight-up pancake.
Macho goes for a pile driver, but Patrick stops him, so Savage attacks him and a cameraman who has gotten in the way.
Madness.
Mm-hmm.
Paige grabs a chair to hit Macho over the head with before rolling back into the ring, where he calls for the finish again, only to be low-blowed. Savage then goes for a vertical suplex, but DDP counters into a diamond cutter for the pin, and no, Scott Hall arrives to kick Nick Patrick while he's making the count.
I've seen a grudge match like this before.
Paige ducks Scott charging at him with a tag belt, taking Hall down with right hands and an atomic drop. But this allows Macho to grab the belt and clock DDP from behind. Scott then delivers an outsider's edge, followed by a Savage flying elbow for the pin.
And the win.
Tony then yells, "We're out of time! Good night, everybody!"
And poof, there they went.
And we go to credits.
It was a quick one.
Tony's getting good at those.
We're running late.
Getting the fuck out of here.
We're running late on that one. So I ask you, gentlemen, what are your overall thoughts of Great American Bash 1997?
I mean, the last match is good, but it's a bummer that DDP lost, obviously. But it doesn't really hurt him, even if NWO is lame. Like, everybody loves Macho Man, and we kind of get it. And I feel like DDP still has long enough legs that, and he didn't lose straight up, that it's okay that that happened. But overall, I don't think it's a bad show, but it's kind of just a weird one.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go along with the bulk of all that. It started off really fun. And then it was just like, all of a sudden, we turned a corner. And it took us a while to figure out how to get back from that corner. Because, I mean, we went from, what was our first match again? Ultimo and...
Psychosis.
Yeah. Started off with a hot one there. Yeah. You know, cooled down a little bit, but still stayed hot with the Steiner tag match. And then it was just...
This show's very...
Conan and Humorous, blah. Yeah. It was Ray... I almost said Raven. Wrath and Mortis and Glacier, blah. The weirdness of the women's match.
That match was great. I like that match.
It just...
It's like
it veered off course and it couldn't figure out how to get back, and then it overcorrected, and yeah, then it just became...
Yeah. Too and maybe much like the match order, like even if all the matches happened the way that they did, maybe... Just a change of placement could have made it feel more consistent.
Yeah, it's as a visual representation of the difference between ordinary and extraordinary. It's just that little extra,
yeah.
And that little extra was missing to where it just it was just ordinary.
Yeah,
yeah. This show is kind of all over the place. There's some highs, but they're counterpointed by some. Bad decisions.
Yeah, and the lows aren't, like, crazy low. They're just, like, they're not low enough to be interesting. They're just, like, middling enough to be, like, boring or not exciting.
Yeah.
Which is almost worse sometimes.
So it just kind of makes the show, like, average.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with the show, but, like, there's nothing that, like...
It just didn't quite hit.
Yeah.
This is a big... it's like, we made it to first... We hit the ball. We got on first.
And what was the date on the show?
June 16th.
Okay, so this was...
It's Father's Day.
Yeah, it was a week after...
Yeah, this match was not the warm hug promised me.
My thought is, you had this fairly hot show, Monday Nitro. Yeah, there was a lot of brawling and everything, but it...
They didn't quite deliver.
Yeah, they didn't follow up on any of that.
Yeah.
The only mention of Hogan really was talking about Bash on the Beach.
I mean, do we blame Hogan? Because,
he's back filming his movie.
Yeah, Santa with muscles or whatever. It's so crazy to me that he's like, oh, it's Hollywood Hulk Hogan. It's like, what movies were you in that anybody saw or cared about that wasn't fucking Rocky? He's not...
No Holds Barred?
Yeah, sure. That doesn't count. Like
Suburban Commando.
That's Mr. Nanny.
Honestly, those are such like B C films. Like
Surf
he's not
Ninjas they're three or whatever it
they're
was.
He's not Hollywood. That'd be like it would make sense if he was Hogan or if he was in a movie that was even close to as good as Predator or They Live, but like he's just like what's Hollywood about what he did?
Paradise.
He's a failed actor. Like, it's not Hollywood Hulk Hogan.
No.
But I guess that makes it even more of a appeal is that, like, he's bragging about doing something poorly. I guess. I don't know exactly what the takeaway was supposed to be.
Because
I find it hard to believe that anybody was like, oh, yeah, he's a movie star. It's like, no. He's Hulk Hogan. He's the most famous, like, wrestler for the last, like, 30 years. But he's not... He's not a movie star. The only reason he even got to do movies is because wrestling popped in the 80s.
I mean, you've got your Nitro the week before that ends with DDP being lifted up into the air, saved by Sting.
Where's Sting?
Exactly. He shows back up for the pay-per-view and
I mean,
shenanigans happen, but he's just left to deal with it on his own this time.
This is very cartoony, but and would have been hard to do and extremely dangerous. But if Sting just like came down,
picked up
Kevin Nash, and they went straight up, and then DDP finished off Savage, would have been crazy.
That's what they needed to do with a lot of that stuff back then.
Yeah. That would have been insane.
Do those sneak attacks where what the hell happened to my tag team partner? He was just here.
Yeah, and Sting could come down with and like just crack Kevin Nash over the back, so you have the excuse. So the time that it takes for him to clip him up to take him up safely.
I think that would have been too comedic.
It's very funny.
It would have been something that, you know.
It's goofy.
Doink that comes down from the rafters.
Yeah.
That would have been a great gimmick for him.
Yeah, yeah. But like Sting couldn't come down and just like hold him back or crack him with the bat and only Sting goes up. Because if he cracks him with the bat, you know, a bat doesn't mean anything in wrestling now, but it did at one point.
Yeah. Knock him out, push him out of the ring,
yeah.
Go back up to the rafters.
It's like, I don't think this is a horrific show, but.
It's just ordinary.
Yeah.
Good. Where's the smart marks at? All right. Fuck you.
It's time we smart it up. So what are some of the best moments of this show?
I dug the Psychosis and Ultimo match.
Yeah.
While I did kind of complain a little bit about it, I enjoyed the Medusa and Hokuto match.
I like that match a lot. I think that the biggest thing that stands out in my mind from this show is the spot where Hokuto slams Medusa both knees first onto the mat, and like the angle of the shot and her selling, and it just looks brutal and you believe it. It's great.
Now my question is, Medusa actually injured? Is that why she's going to be gone and she's just like getting surgery and recuperating, or do we know?
Yeah, I was curious too, whether like what the actual deal was.
Just because of they played up this injury.
It's a possibility. I did not see anything. I think she was just kind of,
I'm over this shit.
Done with it, because we're not pushing the women.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she was stuck with one company that built a women's division around her and then gave up on it, only to be pulled back by another one that
did the same thing
and had her ruin her legacy throwing a belt in the garbage can.
And the whole time, all of her matches were with like
people she'd already wrestled.
Well, yeah, people she already wrestled and like premier Japanese female wrestlers, like,
yep.
Yeah,
it's like when they brought Hogan over and, you know, all he did was wrestle Boss Man and John Tenta, whatever he was called, the Shark, or whoever he was at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Brutus, you know, people he had already fought before for several years were all of a sudden the new people he was thrown into. Yep. Don't get me wrong. I love me some Medusa Bull Nakano, but
I mean, a big surprise for me is that Kevin Green has the it factor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was like, oh, wow, well,
we said that last year.
Did
that
we?
Was the thing, yeah.
But
was the guy that popped in the match last year.
Yeah, but I guess it's one of those things that it's like, it's been long enough, but he did an even better job this time,
mm-hmm.
as he should.
At the same time, he's in there up against Mongo, so
yeah, but
it takes a whole lot to make Mongo look good.
But Mongo has gotten a lot better.
They've learned his strengths and weaknesses,
and
realize
he has as well.
That he has
yeah.
more weaknesses.
I feel like he understands what he's doing, though. I don't think he's got too big of a head about his capabilities.
No.
So,
he knows where he's.
He's appropriate, like in the situations that are created around him and that he takes place in. But I mean, you mean Savage DDP was.
He says thanks for watching.
Yeah, DDP Savage was so good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the finish makes sense. It's just kind of a bummer. But it doesn't take anything away from Diamond, so.
I mean, it moves along the DDP story, because as much as we'd love to see DDP and Macho have just match after match, we need to separate them.
Yeah.
And move to different things.
Also, dominant babyface is not how wrestling works. I mean, it does. That's what WWF did for so long, but look at it now. They're doing great business with a heel champion for the last, like, 4 years in Roman Reigns. And it's like, well, it's because the chase, it's better to see Superman struggle than it is to just see him, like, flick people off like flies.
Yep.
So it's what wrestling is.
How about most disappointing?
Conan and Hugh Morris having a pretty good match that turned into watching like two turds in a fishbowl.
I don't even know if it started off as a okay
match. I thought it was okay. But disappointing. I think just the pacing of the show, maybe. Because I think that you could have these same matches and move them around.
You'd have these same matches on Nitro. That's the
problem. That is the problem.
Too many of them is they're not pay-per-view matches.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, I know you have to have a bathroom match, but you don't need to have three of them in a row.
Why do you have to have a bathroom match? Everyone says that.
And I don't think you have. I don't think you have to. I think if you're doing it right, you don't have one.
Because it makes the audience feel like you're on their side.
Yeah, there's always going to be something that people care about the least. So by like considering that, that will be the piss match, but it doesn't mean that it's bad. Also. Where's Dean Malenko? Like, I mean, Dean Malenko and Jeff Jarrett had a match like earlier this week on the show we watched last week. It was just as good or better than everything on the show.
Yeah,
well, because they had 9 matches that they already had planned out.
I know. I'm just saying.
Because if you remember Nitro, they didn't talk about Great American Bash at all.
No, they talked about Bash the Beach. Yeah, exactly.
Because they already had these 9 matches ready to go.
Yeah. Same reason why they probably could have got 10,000-11,000 people if they treated the show like an actual pay-per-view. And they kind of didn't. This feels like this is In Your House vibes. Mm. Kind of. But we've seen great In Your Houses.
We haven't had a world heavyweight title match since February. Is not every show that they do without a title shot on it basically feel like an In Your House at this point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except In Your House has title shots.
They do. Absolutely. They're ones where you know that. So, I mean, like,
they're basically just.
Yeah.
Extended Nitro episodes.
It's like, yeah, we know Undertaker's going to retain, but it doesn't mean
they're
going to
flip
suck.
On that and they're going to have all the title shots on Nitro.
Yeah, we're basically at the
now we're changing our mind from being like this was fine and weird to like no it stinks.
We're at the TV era basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's about to be hot potato every week.
How about best performer of the night? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's DDP.
Yeah, I think Savage. I mean, Savage is always good, but I think this was a better Savage than we've seen. On a regular basis, maybe. But we're going to give it to DDP for sure.
Yep.
Because he's the star of the show.
Yep. Should have won his first pay-per-view. Well, I guess it wouldn't technically be his first pay-per-view main event.
No, he won the last one.
That's right. I was thinking Battle Bowl, but then, like, wait. I don't know if that counts.
It won the main event.
But, yeah, to do Outsiders Flair and then do it again and, like, you still don't get a satisfying ending... is wild. It's like, oh, like Ric Flair just like didn't show back up.
It's all telling a story.
The outsiders
aren't losing.
Yeah.
I mean, they've lost the belts like twice, but they just keep getting them back because they don't actually want to work. Scott Hall's probably high as fuck 90% of the time, so.
Yeah, it's a true shame that like they're allowed to just kind of run rampant, but. I mean, there's books about it.
Exactly.
We all know that Scott Hall had extremely, like, a really high ceiling that he lowered for himself. And that also was enabled by guaranteed contract and being able to be his own boss, essentially.
Yep. How about most surprising? Is there anything surprising on the show?
I mean, for me, it's more... I shouldn't be surprised by it, but... That's how Medusa was written off.
Yeah, I wasn't ready for it to be the end, but...
That possibly Hugh Morris is the one who gave us Shucky Ducky.
Oh, okay.
And that mean Gene can be mean when he wants to be.
I mean, yeah, the Gene being that fucking big of a
without
dickhead.
Without realizing he is, I don't know.
Yeah, that was shocking.
Were either one of you surprised when it was Benoit versus Mean and not Sullivan?
I mean, yeah, I was surprised.
Especially after watching the Nitro last week.
Yeah, the Nitro, yeah. I thought he
I was surprised, but
three.
I immediately was like, that's fine, because this will be a better match.
Well, yeah, I was too.
Yeah,
but at the
it
same
was
time,
yeah.
I was just like, but didn't we on literally Monday's show, like, yeah, say,
test
Sullivan's
number three.
Our test number three? I'm like, what? Why would we even bring him out? Like, would you not wait until tomorrow's Nitro to bring Sullivan out for that thing?
And it just feels like you're doing the thing again where it's like, whoa, he just has to get through to Sullivan. It's like, it should be the other way around. You should have to get through Sullivan to get to Ming. Like,
and hell, anymore, Sullivan should have to prove himself to...
Anybody and everybody, Benoit. Yeah. But, you know, love to see Benoit and Ming in the ring. Because you know, they're beasts.
Well, there's another one, I guess, surprising, that Ming tapped out.
I don't know about did surprising.
Did he? That's the thing. Yeah. That finish, did he tap out?
That finish was not well executed.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And then it just got worse from there.
Yep.
Yeah, the double, yeah. This show is kind of like a fever dream.
Because, like, the match is really good.
And then it just...
Except for that it's a death match.
But doesn't like, follow deathmatch rules.
But it doesn't follow deathmatch rules. But the match is really good until the very end. And then the aftermatch stuff is very, very bad.
The aftermatch stuff like just drops it down multiple notches.
Yeah.
Even like if you excluded the like not so great finish.
Because like outside of the main event, that was probably my favorite match.
Until
the last
20 minutes that it took for them to take him out of the ring.
So it's just like...
Yeah. Weird show.
And now for a look back even further into the history of wrestling.
The dusty finish.
Tatsumi Fujinami had become the IWGP Heavyweight Champion at the beginning of April. But now, on May 1st, 1994, at Wrestling Dantaku, he would have to face the former champion, Shinya Hashimoto. As soon as the bell rings, Fujinami is on the defense as Shinya starts kicking. Tatsumi returns fire, but Hashimoto's arsenal is too much, forcing Fujinami to roll out to regroup. Once he returns, Shinya picks up where he left off, only for Tatsumi to catch a kick and begin working several submissions, such as an STF and a sleeper. But when he tries to transition into a dragon sleeper, Hashimoto blocks and counters to regain control. Shinya would then take Fujinami to a corner with multiple strikes, connecting over and over with high kicks, before delivering a jumping DDT for the pin to become the IWGP Heavyweight Champion for the second time. Hashimoto would defend the title over the next year until a fellow musketeer would look to end the reign.
Dun dun dun.
I'm always here for Hashimoto.
Yep.
Love him. Big fat man doing kicks.
Next week, In Your House 16, Canadian Stampede.
We're going to the northern version of the south.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Calgary.
Cowtown.
The Deep North.
The Deep North.
As they say the on How I Met Your Mother.
I was about to call it. I've never heard that before. It's funny. Yeah. The Deep North.
The music from this week's show is Two of Them by Phil Harrod, Reed Hayes, and Scott Shear. And Macho Man won our main event. But he's using NWO music, guys.
No.
Rock House by FCB Music. If you like this show or any of our other ones, please go out there, rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts at. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns...
We're going to Canada. What do they have in Canada other than poutine and... Yeah.
Don't say poutine.
Tim Hortons.
Oh, yeah. They have Tim Hortons.
Isn't Tim Hortons just a poutine shop?
No, it's a donut shop.
Oh, okay.
Molson...
Molson, Labatt Blue.
There we go, Labatt. I'm like, what's that bear beer? I can't remember.
Labatt Blue. I don't know. Email Bret Hart.
There we go. Let's give that a try. But yeah, we're going to Canada. We're going to Calgary. What the hell should I bring? I have nothing off the top of my head at the moment. So give us some ideas, some suggestions. What do you eat when you're in Canada? What did you eat when you've been to Canada? What should I eat if I'm going to Canada? Hit us up on the app formerly known as Twitter and slide into our DMs. Something. Give me some ideas, because maybe that's a reason that this little food from today didn't work out, because it was basically like a poutine burger. So maybe we'll have to redo. Whoa.
Sorry.
But you can do any of those things through email at wrestlinghistoryx@gmail.com or find us on X at wrestlinghistorex. That's wrestling HISTOX. We'll talk to you next week.
Laters. I know it's not the right song, but I want it to be.